ICIS News reported last Friday that panic buying conditions are starting to ease in European polyolefins markets. Sentiment is changing in Asia too. Can we see now the light at the end of the tunnel for the current extreme supply and demand conditions affecting global, but particularly European markets? And how can we make supply chains more robust for the future? I'm Will Beecham, and joining me to discuss these important topics this week, I'm joined by our regular team of panellists, John Richardson, who's ICIS Senior Consultant for Asia, Nigel Davis, our Insight Editor, and Paul Hodges, who's Chairman of New Normal Consulting. So gents, first of all, I'd like to get your views on current chemical market dynamics. Our colleague Linda Naylor wrote on Friday about sentiment changing in European polyolefins markets. To give a bit of context, regional supply across many value chains is still being battered by multiple force majeures and the ongoing container crisis, which is starving the region of imports. Stocks are low and there's been a lot of panic buying by downstream customers who fear their production might be jeopardised. On the other hand, demand seems to have been robust despite the current wave of virus lockdowns. Let's start with you, Nigel. What's your feeling about the situation in Europe? Do you sense that it's easing for chemical markets?
Well, I think if you, certainly with one of our reports that last week suggesting that the polymer market might be turning, the sentiment in the polymer market might be turning, and that consumers really have perhaps had enough, you know. But the thing is, they still need the product. You know, this is the big problem throughout these supply chains, or not the problem so much. It's that the consumers or the customers still want the product, and they are prepared to pay quite extraordinary prices, certainly spot prices, for supply. And it's that disruption to supply that's the key here, I believe, and we'll talk about that later. But I think producers and consumers across the sector really are scratching their heads thinking about, you know, what is this recovery? Where is it going? I mean, if you look at the first quarter financial results for the chemical majors, some very, very strong performances there. I mean, ExxonMobil's chemicals numbers ExxonMobil's chemicals profits accounted for 52% of the corporation's earnings in the first quarter. You know, so something's going right somewhere, and I think it's price largely, but also there's been an increase in volume. We know that capacity utilization of the chemical industry has turned up remarkably, and plants are running flat out, hence sometimes there's sort of maintenance problems or running issues that for certain facilities. But, you know, when is this train going to run out of steam? I think that's the big question. And we're looking at almost recessionary conditions in the EU. We're looking at lockdowns affecting, you know, markets across the world, really. And you do really ask yourself, well, how long can this continue? The automobile industry is doing reasonably well. Demand into autos is quite strong. Again, we have chemical CEOs scratching their heads and asking the question, well, what's going on here? But it doesn't stop them actually, you know, being able to raise their guidance for the full year, because, you know, we seem to be pushing these quite strong performance times for the producers, certainly, much further into the year.
John, you've written an excellent blog post which appears in this week's ICIS Chemical Business as well. Do you think that supply situation is gradually improving and that sentiment's changing, particularly in Asia?
Well, if you look at China prices, for some grades have been coming down for 4 weeks now, polyethylene and polypropylene. So let's deal with China first of all. I think the issue in China, as I've been pointing out since January, really, there was a risk of this. So I was saying since January, they would see a quarter on quarter slowdown. And the data confirms my suspicions that the supply chain issues of the container freight crisis, semiconductor shortages, seem to have been limiting Chinese exports of manufactured goods. And that was so important for petrochemicals demand last year. It's a China in, China out story that I've talked about. The 27% increase in polypropylene imports, polyethylene imports up by 12%. It was an extraordinarily good year in China. So we've had this deceleration from quarter to quarter. And the domestic economy is not doing great. Smaller companies are struggling to access financing, and they're struggling with the high cost of raw materials. So you've seen, you know, quite soft pricing in China for a while now, and this massive divergence between China, Turkey and Europe, you know, record high differentials in pricing. I mean, you know, polymers $1,000 a ton more in Europe than in China. And the other thing you've got to consider is China's self-sufficiency, which is a particular issue for high-density polyethylene, styrene, polypropylene, paraxylene, and ethylene glycols. Polypropylene, the capacity is going up by 15% this year. And now China's got export-focused PDH-based polypropylene plants on the coast that are being built to serve export markets. So we're seeing a rise of exports from China of polypropylene to Asia mainly. So some real changing dynamics, a gradual slowdown in China, which has been on the cards for months, rising self-sufficiency we've known about since 2014. So you've got a deflationary push from China on pricing. This, you know, seems to have picked up quite a lot of momentum over the last few weeks. Southeast Asia, you've got a lot of very developing countries there. And everything's gone down. Demand for everything has gone down because of the pandemic. So they're really struggling. And the converters really had no choice but to pay these high prices till last week, even though, you know, demand has not been great. You know, when they wanted the material for sort of vital packaging markets, they were having to pay for it. But now, because supply is lengthening from the Middle East, that's put them in a better position. And awful things are happening in India. The tragedy of India means that cargoes that would have gone to India are being diverted to other markets in Southeast Asia, and India's exporting more polymers because, of course, the demand in India has been very badly affected by the pandemic. So that's the situation in Asia.
Thank you, John. Paul, what's your feeling about the supply-demand balance in chemical markets? Do you see markets starting to, in quotes, normalise as the year progresses?
Yes and no, Will. I hope that's a very helpful answer.
That's a good start.
So, yes, I think that we're probably coming to the end of the first phase of the supply chain chaos. And, you know, as John and Nigel have been saying, you know, your first reaction when supplies go tight is simply to buy whatever's available and hope it arrives. As we've discussed several times on this podcast, you know, the worst thing that can happen to a procurement person is that their plant runs out. You know, if you pay too much money, you may lose a bit of your bonus, but if your plant runs out, your job is at risk. So you go out and you buy several times, and you know, talking around the industry over the last 3 months, that is exactly what everybody has done. So if John says he's got some product, I'll buy that from him. And Nigel says he's got some. And if you've got some, well, I'll buy that as well. And I'll say to myself, look, I'm going to use it in the end. But, you know, hopefully one of them might arrive before my plant runs out. And we've been through that phase. You then get to the next stage, which is, of course, because you've trebled the amount of demand that you've got, apparent demand, you now see prices moving up. And they move up exponentially. When I was an oil trader, we used to have a phrase called the barge in New York Harbor syndrome. And if the market got a bit tight, somebody would make a call and say, look, have you got a barge of gasoline? And, you know, he'd make five calls. And so one barge demand became, in market terminology, five barges of demand. So we all got terribly excited and we all pushed up our prices. And then we discovered afterwards that it was only one barge, and so prices went back down again, which is great fun if you were a trader, but not so good if you didn't realise what was happening. So I think that we're going to be now in the downside of this game, where it's pretty clear that supply, except in the States and in Latin America, is very, very strong. If you look at the American Chemistry Council data on capacity utilisation, which is the best data we have. We haven't got March yet, but we have February. And February was back pre-2008 peaks. without the states. The states is still down. So, that is an extraordinary amount of production. The problem is it hasn't been able to get anywhere because ships have been in the wrong place, containers have been in the wrong place, and all the other problems that we've talked about. But that all it will all arrive, because that's what happens in the end. So we're going to find quite a lot of material, and you go out. I mean, I thought it's quite interesting. If you look at US ethylene over the last 2 weeks, you know, it was up at 57, 59 cents. Then it popped down to 40 at 48. And then it popped one. There was one deal back at 57. And then it popped right down, into the 40s again. And so that's a very interesting early warning, if you like, that you've just taken 20% off the price. More, in fact, if you take versus the peak, which I think was about 64 or 65, you've come down a third in a matter of days. And there's probably more to come. So because now people have got all this product and it all starts to arrive, and the warehouse people say, well, excuse me, where am I supposed to put all this stuff? And you go, I better sell some. And you try, et cetera. And then there is this other element, which is that we're not, and this is why I said yes and no, Will, because the no bit is we're not going back to the world that we knew. We know perfectly well that people are not going to go back to work in offices in the way that they did before. We know perfectly well now that people are not going to be buying gasoline and diesel cars in the way that they were before. They are certainly buying houses, but they're buying houses out of cities. They're not buying them in cities and so on. So there's an awful lot of paradigm shifts going on here. So, with paradigm shifts, you can hope that you understand the direction of travel, but you'd be an idiot to try and say, well, this is going to happen tomorrow and that's going to happen the day after, because how can you possibly know? We're in the middle of major transformational change, and we're not, in the chemical industry, we're not in that moment where we can say this is how it is, because we're dependent on the auto industry, we're dependent on the electronics industry and so on, and we don't have the end user knowledge that we would need to make a call. So we've got to remain flexible.
Well, now I'd like to get your views on how the industry could avoid the mistakes of the past. Weaknesses in global supply chains have been exposed by the pandemic and the storms in the US. We've seen record prices caused by severe drought of chemicals in different regions. Europe's been all but cut off at some points from Asia imports by container ship. And then there's the semiconductor shortage, which is messing up automotive and electronics production. So how should the industry do things differently in the future to make supply chains more robust? I'm thinking about ideas such as more local or regional sourcing and production, or diversifying supplier bases and possibly holding more inventory. John, would you like to start by giving us any ideas that you've got?
I think just-in-time delivery seems to be coming to an end. You see that in the auto industry, that they start thinking, well, we just can't keep lean stocks anymore that depend on these really long supply chains. When it started in Japan in the 1950s, everything was made in Japan, but now you've got supply chains spread across the world. So you're going to have to hold more buffer stocks. You're going to have to look at the old Henry Ford model, where they used to have their own steel plant. I'm not sure if we'll go back to that, but they'll be also looking at how do we localize some of these supply chains, as well as holding more buffer stocks? Because there's so many issues around, the supply chain issues have been there with containers for many years. When you talk to people, say, well, actually, the container business has been really strained for many years. It's been a very delicate balance of all the containers being just about in the right place at the right time. And the pandemic's just tipped it over. So I think we'll see some major changes. I think also you're going to probably see distributors probably offering, logistics as part of the service to some people. And that might become necessary. They do already, but you might see more of that. But I think, definitely more just, less just in time and more investment in local supply chains, I think.
Thanks. Paul, what are your views on how do we make on making supply chains more robust for the future?
Well, I follow on from what John has been saying. There's an interesting CBS, US television network, interview with the new CEO of Intel this week. in which he says, look, the problem with Intel is that we're 3 years behind TSMC in Taiwan. He said, and I've discussed this with the board before I agreed to take the job. And the reason we're 3 years behind is we spent all our spare cash in the last 10 years on share buybacks, and we've not been investing in our core business. And to be honest, I think that's true of a large number of industries, that they focused on this, you know, what was the idea of shareholder value became everything to the shareholders. And so we've got very vulnerable businesses because we haven't, you know, as John says, they haven't got sufficient inventory. You know, just in time is fine if you're in a world where nothing ever goes wrong. Well, nobody lives in a world in which nothing ever goes wrong. And so, and if you're in Texas and you refuse to pay the cost of winterizing your electricity supply, you really can't be surprised if you get the usual winter burst and all your electricity goes down. I mean, this is just as night follows day, really. So what is interesting is that with Joe Biden, you're now seeing the political center move away from this obsession with stock markets and share buybacks back towards a more, I would say, normal idea that the first function of the economy is to keep people supplied, not to make a few 1% of people multi-billionaires. So I think that shift, and of course that shift will go too far in 10 or 20 years' time, there's no doubt about that, but we're at the early stage of the cycle. And what I think is becoming clear is that effectively Biden and Europe, and probably China in due course, are embarking on a form of Marshall Aid plan. Now, for those who didn't study European history, after the war, Europe was in a complete and utter collapse. It had been bombed, you know, first of all by the Germans and then by the Allies, and there wasn't much left of it. And, you know, luckily for Europe, as it were, the Soviets came in and tried to take Berlin, and that worried the Americans because they didn't. If Berlin went, they worried that Europe would fall to the Soviets. It was a very real worry, 47, 48, and so General Marshall persuaded the government to put a vast amount of money into the regeneration of Europe, which laid the foundation for Europe's success in the last 50 years. And of course, you need to renew that. And we should have done that 20 years ago. We didn't. We instead gave all the money to people who wanted to buy large yachts. And so now we're going to have to catch up. But I think that these climate change plans, I mean, they're called climate change or whatever, but what a green recovery plans or whatever. I like the European definition of it as next generation plan. I think that's where we are, that we're finally, the baby boomers are starting to say, you know, we've had a pretty good run. It's time that we put something aside for our kids and our grandchildren. And so I think that we're going to see, if you like, a period of reduced demand over the next few years in a lot of what we would have thought of as being basic items, whilst we invest in the new technologies and the new services. And very much as John said, you know, people aren't going to be buying cars in 5 and 10 years' time, because if you have autonomous vehicles, why would you own a car? You drive a car, it's the second most expensive purchase you make, and you only drive it for an hour a day on average. So why would you want to pay $30,000 or whatever for that? You wouldn't. You much rather, if you've got autonomous vehicles, you will have those. So you'll have many fewer cars being sold. And everybody has to pivot now to the idea of service. VW are talking about becoming a mobility as a service company, not a car company. BMW rebranding, probably, I expect. And so on. So it's really major changes here. Chemical industry's got a good opportunity to do this, but not if it still thinks in terms of selling pounds and tons.
Thank you, Paul. Nigel, if you were a chemical company CEO looking at your supply chain challenges, what sort of questions would you be asking?
I think the questions really are, is as we've just been discussing, you know, are we at that moment where, or the transition really from where we were before to something something different. So, I mean, you know, how will those supply chains look in the future? Who will I be aligned with? You know, do I need to integrate further certain parts of my business? Do I need to look at sort of mergers and acquisitions using M&A as a tool to actually reshape what the company actually is and what the company looks like? Certainly, we're seeing that in the energy space, where we're seeing, you know, sort of the sort of alignment of companies with electricity providers, different providers of different types of power or different types of energy, you know, and different business models there. But certainly, I think in the chemical industry, I think the far-reaching or the chemical companies who are looking to the future will start to think about how do we realign in a world where globalization is changing. You know, we're not reliant as we were on these global supply hubs, global supply chains. How do we become much more efficient ecologically or environmentally, as well as financially? How do we become more efficient in the parts of the world in which we operate?
Thank you very much, Nigel, John and Paul. Well, on Friday this week, we published the ICIS Top 100 Chemical Distributors list, together with lots of analysis of the challenges facing that sector. Look out for the special free download of ICIS Chemical Business magazine, which contains the list. Now, for next week's podcast, we have a distribution special with FECC Director General Dorothy Arnes and some other guests from the world of distribution. And I will also be chairing a free distribution forum with some top CEOs from distributor companies on Tuesday, the 11th of May. I'll put details of how to register in the notes to this podcast.